Welcome to SideQuest. This is an episode where we're going to be talking about our latest obsession, Deadlock. This is a game made by Valve. It's their newest MOBA shooter, still in playtesting. You'd be able to find this on Steam, so I don't expect too many people to know about it, but that's why we're here. I'm going to be joined by Violent Painter.
Hey, hey.
And we're going to be doing a little bit of a deep dive today, covering what it is, why we enjoy it, and some of the thoughts surrounding the current state of the game. As I mentioned, this is in playtesting, so it's not completely finished. Even things like art direction have been changed around since like we've been playing. And when do you, actually, that's a good question. When do you think we started playing?
Shoot. I think we started playing about a year ago, 2024.
Has it really been a year?
Yeah, I think it's been a year at least. I remember last summer is about the time I started playing. And I mean, I do have 1,500 hours.
1,500 fucking hours. Are you serious?
Yeah, 1,500 hours. Well, 1,495 right now, but...
I'm saying that like I'm surprised we had it written down. But
yeah, we did.
It's So yeah, honestly, you know what's ironic is that I remember seeing this game for the first time and they were opening up playtests for those for who had like friends of people who were already in the early access. And whenever that whole thing got released, it actually, I was so excited because it was like, oh my God, Valve is making another game. And basically, you had to go, like, it was kind of just like exclusive. So there was some sort of like,
there was
kind
of
like an exclusive factor. Yeah. So like,
yeah, you couldn't talk about it publicly. It actually ended up getting leaked.
Which is how everyone else ended up getting, it's not, I wouldn't call it open because you still have to be invited. But I mean, honestly, it's really easy to get in if you are trying to get in. I would just look it up. I think that so there's like a Reddit thread somewhere that I had to do. But basically, I just messaged someone or I put a post there on that little Reddit thread that asks, you know, if you want an invite. Someone messaged me via Steam and then I was able to get in. But I remember playing my first few games. This is coming from someone who has a lot of experience, like a couple thousand hours and a couple thousand dollars into Overwatch. And the as you know, I'm going to go on a quick rant here. As Overwatch kind of became this thing that I just could not respect anymore, it left such a bad taste in my mouth that I just like I quit the game completely. I uninstalled my Blizzard launcher. I actually haven't touched it in a couple of years. I think the microtransactions were just getting too egregious. I think the team, you know, ever since Jeff Kaplan left, you know, he was kind of like one of the biggest reasons why a lot of people stuck around, because even if, you know, things weren't perfect, they were still being very upfront with us. And I'm not like saying that they're not doing that now. I think things were just better generally whenever Jeff was around. So you have Overwatch 2 basically take over Overwatch 1, which renders, you know, the first insult is that it renders your original $40 purchase like completely for naught. And another rant, I've seen the same exact thing happen to Team Fortress 2. So Team Fortress 2, Overwatch, and Deadlock are all in the same in that they are all technically hero shooters. And if you're unfamiliar with what a hero shooter is, basically you have very specific characters with very specific attributes. Some can fly, some can throw projectiles very far, some use arrows. There's a whole bunch of like caricatures that you can pretty much create out of a hero shooter that makes it conducive for a really nice team environment. And so Overwatch was a game that I was obsessed with for like years. I think I had joined about like a couple of months after its original release, past the beta, so I didn't play the beta, but it was so much fun. I had made so many friends on there, and generally, you know, at least back then, like I thought it was just a really good community. I think the community did get a little bit more toxic as time went on, and you know, admittedly, I was kind of a part of that.
Well, internet video games.
Yeah. Just you know, dumb competitive nature.
Oh yeah, it's gonna happen.
Yeah, it's like when I saw TF2, which I originally had purchased, I think it was like in 2010 or 2012, for like $20. And looking back now, I wish they would have just kept that model. I think if you want to. Basically what happened is that like once TF2 went free to play, the game became riddled with a lot of problems, basically. And, you know, my first impression whenever it went free to play was that it, I was like, great, my friends aren't willing to spend the $20 to play this game. So, like, it's great. I can show them the game. They're going to love it because I can show them why I love it. And then everyone's going to have a good time. I'm going to have more friends to play TF2 with. So that's, I think that was the, like, intention. What ended up happening was that you get bots that just fill these games up. And it was completely relentless. Like, you really couldn't get into a game without someone cheating. Like, it was just impossible. I think since then, you know, they've kind of been able to work and get a lot of this botting stuff down, but it was a really big problem. I will admit, before it ever reached like a really serious point, Overwatch had come out. And so when I started playing Overwatch for the first time, I was really surprised. I was like, man, I was like, the quality of this is like really good. The models look really good. The environments look really cool. And there's different types of characters. There was a floating character, Pharah, who's she has like rocket boots and she uses rockets. And I was like, it was like the first time where I was like, man, this is like cheating. Because I'm like just up from above shooting rockets down at people. They're just dying. It just seems like so easy. And I'm just like, I don't know if this is like I should be this good. And then like, as time goes on, you get more familiar with the game. Everyone gets more familiar with the game. And you're now, you know, if you use Pharah, it's a pretty easy kill, you know, just depending on who you choose and how you choose to counter it. Which we'll go into one of the main differences here is that like during a game of Overwatch where you're, you know, 6v6, you know, it can be a control point where you're both fighting for the same spot. And you have to remain in a certain amount of time within this certain spot in order to control it. And then the timer runs down. And then there was also payload where you would transfer a payload. In a lot of games, it's like a bomb. In TF2, it was also just like this gigantic bomb. And you would deliver it to the other side, the opposing team side, where it's more like a attack and defend. And both TF2 and Overwatch had that, but Overwatch just had this polish that I'm not going to say that Valve didn't have the polish, but it was just something that it was just new, you know, it was just like a new shiny toy that it just like, I felt like it did a lot of things better. I think it was more diverse in the character selection, different archetypes. I thought it was kind of refreshing that like every character didn't have 4 or 5 attachments that you could use with every playthrough. Or every game, and it was, I just felt like it was guided better too. Because TF2, I go to TF2 if I'm looking for chaos. If I want something more structured, then I'll probably go to Overwatch. They both serve the same purpose. Each of them are incredible games. Each of them have really great art direction, and I love Valve, and I did at one time love Overwatch. But as time went on, you know, the transactions just got super like crazy. People used to complain about the loot boxes where you would earn cosmetics and all sorts of stuff for these characters, which, you know, they didn't alter the gameplay in any way, except for maybe mm-hmm. how you look at them. But it was just enticing enough for me to spend a good amount of money on it, mainly whenever it came to, like, holiday stuff. Like, oh my god, the first Halloween that I experienced, I'm pretty sure I put down, like, at least, like, $150. And it was really just to have, like, these really cool skins.
Holy.
Yeah.
League of Legends would get me like that, with skins and recolors and new art. Yeah, transactions can get a little overwhelming, but when I looked at the two games, Overwatch and TF2, as far as like art direction, I wouldn't mind spending some on cosmetics for Overwatch. I think it looks nice. I haven't played it much, but it looks cool. The characters like look memorable and lovable. And with TF2, I know they are iconic characters, but, just me personally, I don't really like have an attachment to the characters like Spy and Heavy and Scout mm-hmm. or whoever they are. I didn't play much of them either, but I think that's where Deadlock really excels is their character design and art. And I am just dying for some cosmetics. Like, take my money.
Yeah, we got a taste of these cosmetics like back last Christmas. And you had to do like a special challenge for each character. I'm not going to say every single character because each character had their own special challenge, and it was conducive to like what their abilities were. So you had to do, you know, a certain ability this way, or, you know, get this amount of kills or whatever.
Catch this amount on people in your ult. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, that, I think, was just a really cool way to introduce that. But, like, the sad thing is that the cosmetics weren't permanent. And so, like, you don't get to keep them, even if you did earn them. I have a feeling that they'll be brought back and we will get them back. I just feel like Valve will do us well by that, like that. But it's... Since spending a lot of money on Overwatch was just kind of like a problem for me, and especially once Overwatch 2 launched and didn't follow through with any of the promises, which were, you know, let me back up a little bit. So Overwatch is a 6v, sorry, 5v? It's now a 5v5. It used to be 6v6. It turned into 5v5, and there was a lot of controversy about that. We can go into that later. Well, I'll do another episode on Overwatch, and I'll bitch more about it. But, so... Lots of changes, you know, it seemed like Overwatch was losing its direction. And then whenever Overwatch 2 came out, the only difference between Overwatch 1 and Overwatch 2 was really just how you unlocked cosmetics, which were now, you know, through a battle pass. And then all of the skins that were previously available, you know, through loot boxes and other ways, like you could definitely earn your way into a nice cosmetic. Now it had to be straight up purchased. And, you know, there's something to be said about like how microtransactions are, but like I feel like for what it was for the loot boxes, I felt like it was actually reasonable, weirdly enough. Now, if you're not the type of person to spend any sort of money on like games, that's completely your prerogative. I was not that person either until Overwatch, but I think this was the first time I had ever felt FOMO, a fear of missing out. And if you didn't get these Halloween skins or these Christmas skins or, you know, the summer skins or any other holiday that they could wrap their head around, it was, you know, it just meant that you weren't going to be able to access that kind of reward for the rest of that year or until that holiday rolled around again.
And if you don't have those rewards, you're not a dedicated player, are you?
Yeah.
If you don't have those cosmetics.
It is kind of like a weird flex, but like the thing about Overwatch 1 is that like everyone had the ability to at least earn these cosmetics one way or another. In Overwatch 2, it basically started out to where you cannot. To be fair, it's been a couple of years. I think it's been like 2 years now since I've played it. So I'm not sure if anything like that has changed. You can let us know in the comments. I did not bother downloading the game again to see what's going on because I just don't. It's so far out of my mind. I'm still bitter about it, though, obviously. Deadlock, I would say the similarities between Deadlock and Overwatch are their interesting art directions. And I will disagree with you a little bit on the TF2 thing. I do think those characters are iconic, especially like a person like the Heavy. I think, though, what is kind of lost between between Overwatch to TF2, if you were going to look at it that way, is that the TF2 characters operate more in like a uniform fashion. So you have Team Red and then Team Blue, and then you have like offshoot not neutral tone, but just like different cosmetics that you could put onto each character, and they would reflect whether you were on red or blue. In Overwatch, they're just straight up like whole skins. So maybe you had a normal skin Pharah, but now you have this like really cool ghost purple dead looking Pharah, and they also had one where it was like she had, you know, looked like Anubis and she was golden. That was my favorite.
That's
one.
That's cool.
And so there were just so many different ways that you could express yourself in that game. So the way that TF2 does it, it's the big thing was hats. Hats were like crazy. And like I've put in 1700 hours into TF2, and I'm not gonna lie, a lot of that was, so TF2 had these hats and you were able to trade for them, you were able to earn them through boxes, and so the hats were a big deal. That was the best way that you could express yourself. And then they introduced, you know, accessories, and you could get, you know, goggles, you could get, sometimes they had gloves, pins, things like that that you could do. And then they kind of just get more elaborate as time goes on if you look down the timeline. So there was a lot of expression there. It's just, I would say, a little less accessible, because you either have to put in the time or you have to spend the money, which I don't think either is like a terrible choice, at least not back then. But TF2 used to have this economy, I want to say like Counter-Strike, which has a bunch of skins and things that you can purchase for your guns and stuff, where it used to operate kind of like a marketplace. I spent a lot of time meeting friends and like trading in these marketplace servers, basically. It's more than just like playing the game. You're also just, you know, shooting the shit with someone and you're trying to trade for a better hat, you know, just because, you know, that was a fun thing to do. It's a way to grow with the community. And I thought it was really cool. And then Overwatch kind of just simplifies it. And I think that was good. You can earn it. And then once you get to Overwatch 2, these skins are now like anywhere from $15 to $30. I think I saw one recently, which was like $50. And I think I saw one that was, it was something golden. I'm okay with being wrong. I'm pretty sure, but it was golden. It was for like a brand and it was like $80.
Woo.
And that's when like I saw that. I remember seeing D.Va and this brand. I'm not going to mention the brand, but like I saw this branded, you know, skin and I was like, oh my God, this is no longer anything like it used to be. This is a shell of itself. This is no longer going to be viable for me. And I see where this is going. They haven't delivered on any of the promises, and that is why I had to leave. But Deadlock does something totally different. First of all, default skins in this game are all incredibly like imaginative, and they have a really good style. I would say it's like 40s, 50s style, and they have like a lot of ghosts involved. So think of like 40s, 50s, kind of like almost steampunk. It looks kind of steampunkish.
It's like a cult. Yeah. These 50s occult kind of vibe. Like magic has suddenly entered into the world through a maelstrom of sorts. And so each character has their own like motivations and things they want to get from the ultimate goal, which is to summon a patron through a ritual. And that is the core goal of the game, is summoning the patron by defeating the other team's patron.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole vibe is so cool. And all of the characters are freaks, each with their own detailed or not yet fleshed out lore. So It's still totally work in progress, but it's been one of the most interesting aesthetics I've ever seen out of a game, especially one coded like a multiplayer hero shooter. You've never seen a vibe like this. Usually it's like more of like a futuristic or a cyberpunk kind of look, but this is so fresh, which this game used to be a kind of a cyberpunk vibe. It used to be called Neon Prime.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
But then they just adjusted the art direction 100%, complete 180. And I can't believe they did that out of nowhere. But I think that's exactly what it needed to just make the initial draw so nice.
It gives off this timeless vibe that I think, you know, there's one part like familiarity and then one part intrigue where you're wondering like, what do ghosts have to do with this world? What the fuck is a patron? And like all this other stuff. Before we kind of dive a little bit deeper into that, I know that I come from an Overwatch background, but Painter, you had experience with another game, right?
I did. League of Legends. So Deadlock being a MOBA hero shooter mishmash, a genre mishmash, basically, kind of makes it feel like, yeah, if you combined Overwatch and League of Legends. I never played Overwatch, never played TF2. I played a little bit of Overwatch on the Switch, and it just didn't run right. But I played a whole lot of League of Legends. I haven't played since 2015. It's been a while. But I played a lot, put a lot of hours in. God, that game's old now. It's the strategy of a MOBA is so cool. And it's a little bit like a hero shooter in that each character has their own unique abilities that operate differently in a team fight. Like there's crowd control, which means like stunning someone or stopping them in their place, lowering their resistances. They have all kinds of things like that in a MOBA, like League of Legends or Smite. And I really like how many things you have to think about, like your own score, your own level throughout the game, what kind of items you're buying, how are the lanes doing? Because in a MOBA, you have multiple lanes that are being pushed, which means our minions are fighting their team's minions, and they're pushing each other in this fight to take eventually their objective, ultimate objective.
Think of it like a football field. Like you have the 50-yard line, and then you have the 100, and then you have the the touchdown zone on each end, right? The MOBA is pretty much like that. Like, you're trying to get your minions to be able to cross to the other side so that way you can take the final objective. And there's two other objectives in that path that you have to overcome. And it's basically a race to the finish for each team. So that's probably the simplest way that I could put it. It's kind of like football.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, that's essentially League of Legends. You might have heard of it. It's very, everyone says the community, of course, is toxic. Yeah. But I think that's honestly a hallmark of a really well-designed game. People are very passionate about it. And they get angry.
Yeah, and honestly, there was a, I remember seeing a video once of Gabe Newell. I think he mentioned that he was playing Counter-Strike, but
Dota 2.
Oh, it was Dota 2. Okay, so then he was saying something about it. He wasn't even complaining, but he was just saying, like, yeah, I had a couple of fellow players, you know, say some really crazy stuff to me, and, you know, I don't take any offense to it. It just means that they're passionate about the game. And so, like, I think you hit the nail on the head with that. You know, it just means, it means that, you know, if, I think we talked about this at another podcast, but basically there's loving a game, there's hating a game, and then there's indifference, which, you know, I became indifferent to Overwatch, but there was parts where I loved it and then parts where I just hated it. I feel the same way with this game, and it's one of the few games that, because you have to think about so much, and we joke about this all the time, talking about micro and macro decisions, just, we'll get into that here in a sec, but you love the complexity. I love that, like, it's a game that you have to grow into, but the problem with a game like this, I would think, and I've observed personally through some of my other friends, is that it takes time to understand everything about the game.
It's hard to get into. It's hard to get your friends into it. There is so much to think about. And it's like, who has the time? I've heard that Deadlock is not a game for employed people because it's just so much time and so much investment to think about. And every game is like, is going to be a good 40 minutes of your time guaranteed.
Yeah. I think the quickest game that we've had was, I think I've never seen it go below like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the highest that I've seen was an hour and 10 minutes, which those are grueling games. But generally, your games are going to be around like 30 to 45 minutes. So having to commit to that kind of time, it can be challenging for people. And then, especially if the games are running 45 minutes a pop, then you run three games in a row, you know, and that's like in a row, because like we would play the game, we would lose.
It feels so bad when you lose.
Yeah.
If you've ever played a long game and lost, you just got to play another. You can't end on that loss.
Yeah.
Not
exactly. Exactly. And you have to do it again. And you just want to keep going until you do and you have something satisfying. I think, though, that would probably be my first, I'll call it a criticism. I think it's nothing to do with the game, really. But I think it just has to do with, like, the mode itself. So I'm going to be the first to tell you that I'm like, I love the shit out of this game. I do not feel like I'm that good at it. Like, I think it took me about like 200 hours for something to click in my brain and be like, oh, I could do it this way. And then things were a little bit better since they've been adding like new characters and changing the dynamics of like how players interact with the world, or they used to have teleporters that were more frequent in the map where you could get around a little bit more quickly. I became more frustrated with it because I felt like these were things that helped the game. But when you look at it as from a higher level view, you can see why the decisions were made. And I've had a lot of internal battles whether I even wanted to keep playing this game. But it's just like, that's the thing, is that I am extremely passionate about this project. But that being said, to have someone commit to a 45 minute game and to do that like three times a night, we were doing that for like months straight. Like I don't think I did anything except get off work, get to my computer, and then we would put like three or four games in that night. League of Legends folks already know this was a huge like difference for me, because Overwatch, you have games that are like 15-20 minutes max, and so if you lose Or if you are starting off really bad, you know, at
not
least
a big deal.
Yeah, it'll probably be over within the next 5 minutes because they're just rolling us, or you have a more interesting game where you're able to come back, have a little Cinderella story, and that's kind of nice. But I think in a game like Deadlock, if you suck in the first phase, it's called the laning phase. We'll get into more detail about that. Then you're pretty much opening up the door for that whole game to suck for your team, whether it's because you're feeding, which feeding just means that you are, anytime that you kill another character, you gain a certain amount of souls. The souls give you an advantage because you're able to use those souls as currency to purchase items. Those items give you even more advantages. So on top of getting like a strength, a gun, or an ability boost, you're also able to buy items to enhance that even further. So if you... I still struggle with this, but if you die within like the first 10 minutes, you're opening the door for basically just get steamrolled. So you have to be really careful in the laning phase. So if you're the type of person that thinks that like run and gun is probably your kind of game, you got to think about it a little bit more carefully than that. Now, you want to there's characters that are conducive to every playstyle. That's the beauty of games like this. Because it can allow for a wider range of skill whenever it comes to shooters and you know, things like MOBAs. Because I was new to MOBAs starting Deadlock, and all I really had experience with was payload and control points on Overwatch and TF2.
Yeah, so I like characters like that can get out a lot, and so there's a lot of choices for me. Like there's Lash. There's Ivy. Lash has a lot of movement. He can use his 2 ability, Grapple, where he's able to grab onto any enemy, any small little trooper or minion, and he can launch himself very far off of that. If there's none of that around, though, he's screwed.
Or Ivy, your own teammates, right?
Can fly away. Yeah, or your own teammates. You can just grapple on them and jump away. Ivy can just fly away. That is her ultimate ability. And she can also fly a teammate out of danger. And so I noticed, like, in my own play style, that speaks a lot to me overextending a lot. I go too deep. So Valve has characters for me. Maybe I should try more characters that can get out. And so that's good. They also have aim characters. No, yeah, you're good. Like if you're a shooter player, you want to play a Haze, you want to play a Wraith. If you have really good aim, they have Mirage, they have Mina, they have all kinds of options.
Vindicta
for any
sniper.
Kind of player. Vindicta, yeah. Paradox. All very lovable, memorable characters, but...
Yeah, each very unique. Mm-hmm. And like someone like me, for instance, I like burst damage. So when I'm playing Overwatch, my characters was basically Junkrat. Junkrat was my main because you could literally throw in like 3 or 4 bombs at once. If you're aiming correctly, then you'll typically kill someone, and then you can just bounce out, you can just dip. So that's kind of always been my play style. Whenever I started, I started playing with Abrams, which is this detective demon guy, and he has this book which allows him to press 1 and he can basically just drain the life out of like another character if they're within his range and they're in front of him, which is something I learned. I thought it was all around, but it turns out it's just in front of him. But that is more conducive to like close combat gameplay because he also uses a shot. It's like a revolver shotgun pistol, basically. So it's very big emphasis on like close range combat.
Brawler type.
Yeah, definitely a brawler. Like the main point of Abrams is that his melee attacks do a little bit more damage than everyone else. So on the caveat to that being, he doesn't regenerate as much health in the beginning. Well, we can get into builds and stuff here in a bit because I can easily...
That's quite a topic.
Yeah, that is quite a topic. But
how about we start out with like how a general game goes, like from start to finish.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Do you want to start or should
I go? Yeah, I'll give it a go. Let's do... So a game being maybe about, let's call this game 40 minutes long. So the first 9 minutes, you and your lane partner, first there's 3 sets of lanes and then 2 people to a lane. So 6 versus 6. You and your lane partner will zip into a lane and it takes you 14 seconds to get there. Your character probably has a little interaction with the other character, which I thought was really nice touch, and gives you a peek into the lore as you're waiting for the game to start. And you can also switch lanes during this time. So if you don't like the matchup that you're given, you can request a switch with someone at the top of your screen. That's really cool if you want to like reorient your team, or like if you understand the other team's abilities, that's a good way to like dig into their weaknesses. A good way to switch is to jump the zip lines instead of using the option above. That way the team doesn't know who's going to show up to the lane.
That's a good point.
But at this point in the game, as soon as you get down, the minions will come a little bit after you. You want to make sure you kill those minions and you kill the soul orb that appears above their head. And you want to do your best to kill the red soul orb that appears from the minions on your side after the enemy team kills them.
Right. So just a recap.
Yeah.
So when you're starting off in the lane, the minions are coming after you. Both parties are in this lane. So minions are fighting each other. You're fighting the minions, and you're also fighting the other players. When you kill a minion, they give souls. In the laning phase, you get like a set specific amount of souls for the first 9 minutes. So you get half, and then if you want the other half, you have to confirm it, or the other team has a chance to steal the souls that are the other half of the souls that come out of a minion by shooting the orb that drops out of them when they are killed.
Yes. So the equivalent in League of Legends, for example, is just getting the last hit on a minion. That confirms, like, you get the money for that. Imagine if you could steal someone else's last hit.
Your opposing team's last hit.
Your opposing team's last hit, yes.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, if you're in the same lane and you confirm it, you get the same amount of souls, right? So if me and Painter are in the same lane, I kill a minion, and let's say, just for as an example, it gives me 50 souls. Painter also gets 50 souls.
Yeah, we get 60, we share 60%. It's most efficient to have two people in a lane. This is always changing, though. Valve is always changing these numbers around.
Yeah. It's part of what makes it exciting.
Yeah. The changes make it fun.
Right. It's frustrating and fun. Like, and we'll go into that. But like, so there's a big emphasis on being able to manage a couple of things. You're managing the distance between you and the enemy player, whether or not you're getting all of the souls from the minions that you're killing. And then the first real objective that you have is called a guardian. Think of it as like your first tower in League of Legends. We don't really have an equivalent in Overwatch. But when you defeat the Guardian, it releases a bunch of souls, and it also has its own way to defend itself, just like any other tower. And you have to be able to defeat the opposing team's minions. And then they also have to be, your minions need to be able to make it up to the Guardian. So that way they can take the brunt of the hit that the Guardian's dealing out. Because if they're not taking the brunt, then you are. And that's going to end very badly for you if you let that go on for too long.
So already that's quite a lot to think about in the first 10 minutes of a game. So it's a little difficult to get someone into it immediately. But once you get the rhythm of it, the variety of, or the difference in feel from late game to middle game to early game is so different. It's just so easy to get hooked, to just queue for another game and then do this for the next 10 minutes.
Yeah, try a new strategy, try a new build, try...
focusing something different, like...
A new character. A new lane placement, even.
New items.
Exactly. And I think... I guess that kind of covers the first part, the laning phase.
Sure.
So let's go on to mid-game.
Yeah. So usually in a game, about 10 minutes in is when the Guardian is defeated and one side is starting to roam around the map. So there are farm camps at three different tiers all around the map. Tier 1, very easy to take. Tier 2, about medium. And then tier 3, they're going to take a long time to take, and often it's just best to get those in the late game. But mid game, here at 10 minutes, the objectives still have a lot of shields. So there's another objective after the Guardian called a Walker. It's a lot larger and a lot more hefty, has a lot more shielding, and that shielding diminishes greatly every minute after the 10-minute mark. And at 16 minutes, they become a lot easier to take. And so during this time, you want to roam around the game map. You want to gank, which means interrupt someone else's laning phase. They might still be working on taking the Guardian. So you want to help them do that. And then once you ensure everybody has taken their first Guardian, that allows you another item slot to purchase items in. Mm-hmm. You do start out with 8, I forgot to mention.
Is it 8 or... Yeah, oh, yeah, so you get a totality of 12. A totality of 12 items and over the whole course of the game, and that's assuming that you get all of the slot unlocks, which have different parameters for each of them. But basically, you get to the end, if you get to the other side, you have all the item slots, basically.
Yes.
You
take you do your best to take your first walker, and that gets you another slot for 10 slots total. Once you take all the walkers, 11 slots, and then one set of the... and then after the walkers, there's a set of 2 guardians at each of the lanes, so 6 total. Base guardians, they're called. And those will give you your last slot. So at this point, after you take a walker... hopefully you're defending your walkers too. There's a lot to manage on the map in mid-game. You have to make sure you have control of the map, the lane isn't pushing too far, and none of your walkers are in danger, all the while making offensive plays and keeping an eye on the enemy team. If you don't see any of the enemy team on your map, then you don't know what's going on. You don't know what they're planning, where they are, and so it's best to be either defensive or have a way out, because they're probably coming for you.
Mm-hmm. And just a side note on that, you do have the ability to ping in this game. And if you do ping, you can reveal that character's location for like a brief second. And if the minions are seeing the enemy, even if you're like on the other side of the map, they will still indicate that they see that enemy, and you'll be able to see them temporarily on the map as well until they leave the minion site.
That's a good point.
So There's lots of ways that, because you're not flying totally blind, which I think is a smart choice for a game like this. And just as a side note, like, I thought it was mm-hmm. worth
it. Is yeah, and after a while you get to late game. It's yeah, the mid game is like a mix of like making yourself stronger and getting objectives, and whereas late game is full on objectives, like you want to, and fights and kills. And there are long respawns, probably around the 25-minute mark is when I'd say you'd enter late game. Everybody's getting strong. Your people that have snowballed like need to start making moves. Otherwise, the other team has a lot of chance to come back and get stronger. There's objectives like the soul urn that can get your team a lot of souls, and it can be used as bait also. The soul urn, to describe it, it's basically small objective that you have to run to the other side of the map, usually from middle to middle, and it's very dangerous. You can't attack while you're holding it, you can't use your abilities, you just have to get it to the other side and then stand in a spot for a few seconds to turn it in and then get your team a whole lot of souls. Everybody can see you while you're carrying the soul urn, the opposing team included, so you gotta get it there fast, and you gotta make sure you turn it in, or you can use it as bait for the enemy team to gather so that your team can converge on an ambush and kill them.
Either converge on an ambush or use that to claim another objective.
True that, yeah. Or draw them away from an objective you're ready to take, another walker. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different strategies. Sometimes they won't fall for the bait, and they send just a couple people that are good at defending urn, and you don't get anything, and you just wasted time, and now they're ahead.
Yeah.
So it's a risk.
Many tragedies, I was going to say, that have happened where, like, you get it all the way to the other side. One thing about the urn that's kind of also important to note is that, like, if you get shot, you don't release the urn from your possession, but if you get punched in any way, I think it has to be a heavy punch, right?
Yeah. I believe. I'll have to check.
And now I'm not so sure. But basically, you can hit someone for sure with a heavy melee move, and they will drop it.
And then most ults will also tear the soul urn out of your hand, except for Ivy. Ivy's stone form is what does it, not her ult.
Oh, yes. So that is to say you've been stunned while holding the urn, and so you drop it. So like if there's any kind of crowd control that you've been affected by, then you'll have released the urn.
Yeah, stun, but not knock up.
Yes, that's yeah, that is true. But that's a little side tangent.
That's a side objective.
Yeah, you can get it. And one of the cool parts about the urn, I think, is that like if you are very ahead of the like, let's say, because everyone's counting their souls, their currency throughout the entire game. And in a way, you're able to kind of determine that character's power level from their soul count, their currency. And let's say your team is pretty behind on like the soul count. If you are able to successfully run the urn from one side to the other, like if you're just slightly below the other team in the soul count, then it gives you a boost, which will either surpass the enemy team's soul count or it'll at least match it. But let's say that you are just having a horrible front start to the game. Two things will happen. Instead of having to run from one side to the other with the urn, it basically makes it to where the urn will have a place on your own side, which is going to be more protected naturally because your whole team is usually on that side. And you're able to kind of turn it in there, and it would be up to the higher level players or the opposing team who has higher level players side to stop you from getting that, which I think is a really good balancing move. On the alternative, let's say that we're still losing terribly and the other team decides to go for the urn. That urn will be in the same place. It would be on the losing team's side where they would have to go a little bit further in order for them to actually achieve that.
It's a lot harder.
It's a lot
more riskier, and sometimes you're so strong that doesn't matter. They can't do anything about it.
And yeah, and those are pretty nice moments because there's a good and a downside to that. Because like if you're on the winning side, it obviously feels really good to be able to take out three or four characters at once and subject them to minute long respawn times versus like being the receiving end of that and. Just be like that's the point of the game where you'll be like, this is bullshit. But it just kind of goes to show, it's like, damn, if I would have had a better earlier game, if we would have been able to strategize more, if my team would have come together to defend this urn placement, then we could have turned this around. And one of the things about Deadlock that I really appreciate is that you have to communicate. I'm not sure how like conducive it was in League of Legends, because I'm not going to say that I'm familiar with League of Legends at all. I've played maybe like 5 games of League of Legends and 5 games of Dota 2. Like, that's my experience.
It's very important. Like, calling your lane missing, telling people where others are. They also have something called vision wards that you can place around the map so that you can keep an eye on certain openings and, like, key spots.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I wish Deadlock had some sort of a vision ward.
I think it kind of works in the opposite way, because they have what is it called? The Veil? The Mystic Veil?
The Veil Walker. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so there are certain walls that will have this veil, and it's basically when you haven't passed through it, and you're, like, seeing it, you know, within your vision, within, like, the first, like, 15 seconds or something like that, then you can't see what's on the other side, even if you're right up front against it. Once you cross that threshold, you can still go back like behind where you just were from the veil, and you can still see beyond it. But that really gives a chance for either side to make a surprise attack at that location.
Ambush spot.
Right. And so to me, now that you mentioned the vision wards and League of Legends, I'm like, oh, they do something like that. It's but it's kind of the opposite.
Yeah.
Which is,
takes vision away in those areas.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So you're getting strong. You got an urn, and you're entering late game, right?
Yeah.
And by this point, you're taking base guardians. Your next objectives are going to be the shrines. There's 2 shrines on the left and right side of your home base. You got to take one of those. You got to take both of those, and then eventually you have to kill the patron above. All the while, their team is right next to a fountain of health that they can heal at and then come and poke you down some and then heal back up, or you're just going to kill them. And then you can kill their patron too. And then you have to kill their patron again after you've killed it when it's floating in the air. And so takes about 12 seconds to drop.
Right. So when you enter the base, the patron's floating there and they're doing like minimal damage. So they're floating in the air. When you take out the shrines, you then kill the patron, and then the patron begins to deconstruct, and it goes a little bit further into the enemy's base, and then it drops after 12 seconds, like you said. And yes. then that is when it's in a weakened state, is what they call it. And so when you kill the patron in its weakened state, you win the game. So, yeah. But the late game is easily the most fun part of the game, because it takes the culmination of your build, what you've kind of done for that game, and it brings it all to a head. And so you're able to utilize your character to its maximum potential, or maybe not, if you haven't made the right build. And that's easily the most exciting part of the game. It's also the scariest part of the game, because if you die, I think the highest respawn timer that I had was like 80 seconds or 85 yes. seconds.
It's long. So
you don't want to die, because being away for that long means that you're not getting souls, which means that you're not leveling up, and the other team is getting souls and they're still continuing to level up. And you mentioned snowballing earlier.
Yes.
Snowballing, just to educate, basically like the metaphor of a snowball, if you roll it across snow, then it continues to get larger and larger and larger. And so you're kind of doing the same exact thing whenever you are getting souls and adding things to your build, getting more powerful. So the metaphor is between not necessarily the character, but just its power. So just to kind of explain that. And so once everyone has been snowballing, whether it's slow or very fast, the team fights that are conducive in the late game are that much more exciting. There's a lot of risk involved. And it's because of that this is when things get really passionate, because if you aren't feeling strong in the late game, then, and I'll go into this a little bit, then you aren't feeling like you have any confidence in yourself, or you may not have confidence in one of your other team members. So I genuinely think that like half the game of Deadlock, I'm not going to speak to MOBAs in general because I'm not going to say that I'm familiar, but like half the game in Deadlock is psychological. Like if you are able to take a beating, like let's say you just die like a lot this game, but you're still maintaining a positive attitude, you are still going to be somewhat ahead of someone who's maybe died once and is freaking out about it.
Yes.
Because that, and I always refer to the movie Crank with Jason Statham more importantly, Paul Giamatti. Paul Giamatti in the movie is just like, I try not to get stressed out, because if I do, then it's something to the effect of like, if you get stressed out, you're 50% more likely to make a rash, irresponsible decision. And so I try to keep myself composed, which is a fucking funny, because Jason Statham has to keep his heart rate up in order to survive. So cool fucking movie if you haven't seen it. But it's the same principle. If you can keep your cool and also work well with your team, then you're going to have a much better time than, you know, someone that is still snowballing, I guess, like beating the shit out of the other team and not playing well with their other teammates.
Yeah. Even if you get behind, there's still ways to help out, like either with your kit or you can buy utility items. There's something called Knockdown that can stun anybody out of a really important game-changing ability, or Silence Wave, which silences their abilities.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Makes it to where you can't use the abilities.
Yeah.
So many dynamics. And so, like, since I'm not that good, I would say I'm going to go ahead and just say I'm adept. I'm not going to say that I'm good. I'm just, like, I'm okay. Like, I can have a lot better, I have a lot more fun during the mid and the late game, because I usually just fucking miff it in the first like 10 minutes during the laning phase. And it's something that I'm still struggling with. And you can watch all the videos on like how to play your character in the most optimized way and all that. But it really just comes down to your decisions, which I guess we can kind of get into micro and macro decisions.
Micro and macro. It's
you go ahead. I want to see how you explain this actually.
Yeah. Yeah. How to explain micro and macro. So I consider macro the big picture, macro, mm-hmm. big. And so that is making sure all of your lanes are pushed and making sure you have like a build in mind or some sort of counter build in mind for what's happening according to their team. And so building your items around that and keeping your waves pushed. As far as micro, I consider that like soul farming and like keep making sure you're saving the right ability points and just getting your money up and your abilities right. So each ability has three upgrades to it. And each of those upgrades can give you a lot for your abilities, whether it's damage, range, or
just sheer effectiveness.
Yeah. And I think managing your money helps you, or I know managing your money gets you your ability points to spend on those upgrades. Mm-hmm. So ensuring you are getting all of the souls, every little bit of that wave, and making sure you're spending every second at max efficiency, like you know when a particular buff is going to appear. So you are spending time running toward that direction, like making sure you're spending the right time at the right time, the right amount of time at the right time doing a particular thing.
The right amount of time is a very important detail too.
Yes.
Because in a game like this, every single second counts, which is why you even have ideas like micro and macro. I also, and I'm okay with being wrong on this, but like I also would consider a micro decision during a fight. Like if your health is going down and you're noticing that your health is going down, but you continue to push forward against the team, then you're making a micro decision to continue facing that team despite the fact that you're low on health. If you go back and go to your base, for instance, to go heal, then that is a micro decision to go salvage yourself. So that's a very broad way of putting it, but it's things like that, like second to second decisions versus over the match decisions. I would probably also putting people towards completing an objective like a guardian or a walker as a macro decision, because that's not a second to second reaction. That's more like we need to go get this so that way we can get our extra slots, and so that way we can become more powerful. This is a decision that everyone has to like, or at least a certain amount of people need to agree on in order for the team to be successful. Which, again, going back to like communication, like any MOBA, like Overwatch, and of course, as Painter mentioned, there's kind League of like
as
a,
well.
There's some toxic things going on, again, like conducive to the genre itself, where you just have people who are passionate, and I think the wholesome way of looking at it is that I just want my whole team to do well and to be successful.
That's right.
The way that it comes out is, what in the absolute fuck are you doing? Like, why are you like, why do you
time?
Yeah, why have you died 8 times this match? It's been 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. No assists.
Yeah, and it's exactly, and it's like, what the fuck are you? And I see one of my examples that I think about the most is like, if we're taking over. No, I think a better example. If the opposing team is in your base, and they're just like going through your shrines, they're taking your objectives, and they're kind of going through it. And let's say there's 5 out of 6 of you at the base defending the base. If someone else is off farming. Or maybe they're trying to complete another objective while, you know, the base, while no one else is guarding any of these other objectives. That's a flip of a coin, whether or not, you know, you want to call them out for being like, hey, like we could use some fucking help here at the base. Or, you know, if they successfully get an objective, it's kind of like,
good job, dude.
It's like, it's good. We could have used the help still.
Yeah.
So you want to be very team oriented. I would say for those that are used to, you know, having the biggest kills, the largest amount of kills in the game, this is really not about that. This is more about completing the objectives and making sure that your team is successful. And you can do that by assisting them just by being beside them, fighting beside them, helping them with farm, like destroying farms, helping someone run the urn, like, you know, so things like that. If someone's getting chased and they're about to die and you manage to kill the enemy player before they killed them, that helps a lot, you know? So it's collaborative things like that that I think are the most challenging part of Deadlock, because especially if you haven't put like that many hours into it, you're not going to understand the nuance of what is to be expected for a while. Again, I'm going to go ahead and say it took me about 50 to like 100 hours for me to get the basics. I didn't really get it until like 200 hours in. This is not to scare you, okay? Like, I'm not saying that you're going to have a bad time between 0 and 200 hours. It's just that there's so much. You could take a class on Deadlock and you would still be wrong in a lot of ways.
I'm still learning a whole lot about Deadlock, and I am 1,500 hours in.
1,500 staggering hours. This dude's always playing it.
I'm always playing this game. Another quick point on micro I wanted to add there.
Yeah.
Like, if you are being chased, like one person being chased by two people, you're interrupting those two people's plans. What if they're planning on taking an objective and they're spending 20 seconds chasing you? That's two people out of the game for the whole team to be working on objectives versus just one, you, being chased. And right. So if you can get those two people to chase you, that's good micro to me.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And that's another thing, kind of going back to, like, if you're the type of person that just wants to have the highest amount of kills in a game, then it's different than what you expect. It would be good to always be able to have the highest amount of kills, mainly because that means that you likely have the most amount of souls. But if you're making a ton of kills and you're not making any objectives, then you're more of a tool of destruction rather than, like, anything that is actually useful towards the objective of the game, which I think a lot of people struggle with in the beginning.
And the right item can still shut down someone who has snowballed so far, like a disarming hex or just a knockdown. I remember one player who was aimbotting on McGinnis. They still lost, even though she was raking in the kills, because there was so many options like metal skin and disarming hex, knockdown, just to make her weaker. Her aimbot didn't even matter. The abilities took her down anyway.
That's, yeah, which kind of just goes to show, like, there is obviously a lot of thought that's put into this game. I know that in the community, there is the main creator of this game, I think, goes by Ice Frog, and he also basically drew the blueprints for Dota 2 and the original Dota, actually. Shout out to Ice Frog, fucking badass. But there's also just, like, fuck, what was I saying? Were we just talking about? Oh, micro decisions.
Micro. We could move to itemization, I think.
Yeah, so anyway, shout out Ice Frog. I love this game. Can't wait to see more. I don't know when the official, like, date will, when it's officially released will be happening. I'm pretty sure it's going to be more than a year from now. But I want to move, we'll just move on to, like, different types of builds. We could spend hours talking about builds.
Oh, yeah.
So I kind of want to try to see if we can give, like, a high-level overview.
Yeah, let's go over the three categories, I think.
Yeah.
So we have weapon, vitality, and spirit. Weapon category, that's offensive weapons that usually buff your character's gun. Each character has a gun or a weapon
that
is ranged. Yeah. Say again?
Oh, so, like, weapon would refer to both the gun and the character's melee ability.
Yes. Yes, weapon damage. You have bullet damage and weapon damage.
Mm-hmm.
Weapon damage is both your bullets and your melee. And there are all sorts of passive stats that you get from all of these items in all categories. So some weapon items might still give you some more spirit power. Some might give you some bonus health. And then we also have the vitality category. This is where you get tanky. You get health from these items, as well as they have their own passives.
Like resistance, which basically just mitigates damage from either abilities or your gun, or other people's gun is what I mean. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where, like, vitality comes in, whether it's extra health, whether it's resistance.
Healing
to
itself?
Exactly. Healing others.
Preventing others from healing.
That too.
And then you have spirit.
And then you have spirit, which basically, to put it very simply, revolves around your abilities. So I used to think that spirit was just like magic and it only had to do with things that were magic, but your abilities are all kind of considered spirit. So even if, like, for instance, the reason why it confused me in the beginning was because Abrams is a very melee heavy character. So his one is just, that would be easy to draw, you know, the fact that it's a spirit, because it's magic, it's draining life from someone. But something like his charge, which is his two, is whenever you press two, he goes forward and he charges someone. It's a form of crowd control that you can use. And if you slam them into the wall, then they are stunned for a period of time. It could be half a second up to a second. I've seen some crazy shit. But that, to me, took me a long time to realize, because if I would have understood that doing that ability would have basically scaled with your spirit damage or, like, your spirit items, then I might have been able to catch on a little bit more quickly as to, like, why things affect the things that they do.
Yes. There are also a bunch of base stats on certain characters that have spirit scaling on them. Like, for example, Gray Talon, he's an archer sniper, but he has spirit scaling on his base move speed. So if he gets a lot of spirit, he goes super fast and he's running around the map.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Seven has spirit scaling on his sprint. So whenever he's sprinting, he's extremely fast if he has high spirit. Paige, she has her melee attacks. Those scale off of spirit. And so she can technically be a melee character just fine.
Yeah, absolutely true. If you're able to combine, you know, let's say I'm going to describe a build that I would typically go for with Abrams, right? So because Abrams starts in the beginning with, I think it's a natural healing rate of 1 per second. And you start off with like 500 or 700. In the game, it's really slow. So everyone's constantly regenerating health no matter what. At any given time, the moment that you stop shooting someone, they are regenerating likely, unless an ability was called where it stops them from healing. That being said, Abrams has the lowest to start off with whenever it comes to that regen. And so usually the first thing that I'll do is pick up regen just so that way I can stay in the lane and just kind of make sure that if I am taking damage, which I likely am because of my adaptability, then I'm able to at least stay in the lane a little bit longer than I normally would be able to. Whenever it comes to like his melee powers, I'll start with melee lifesteal, which means that anytime that I punch someone, it takes a percentage of that damage. I think it's 60% and either 40 or 60% in the beginning. And it adds that to your health, your direct health at that moment. And then it has a cooldown for a couple of seconds before that effect can take place again. This is a recurring trend for a lot of this stuff. So just wanted to throw that in there. If I am going to be going straight melee and I just want all the damage to go into melee, I'm going to be focusing on items that have weapon damage. And I may also, if I have the ability and the room for it, I'm also going to be trying to scale it with something called Spirit Strike, which basically allows your character to basically have scaled melee hits. So there's a couple of ways that you can earn spirit outside of the items that are in the game. They have little boxes, little jars everywhere. And, you know, these are incremental, like super, like, you would
very
think,
small amounts.
Yeah, you would think they're small amounts, but like over the course of a 45 minute game, that can really turn the tide. A lot of new players will ignore these boxes. If this is something that you're going to be getting into, I would suggest just like if you see a box, if you're running by a box, just break it and then move. But when you have more spirit power, then it's going to just do a whole lot more damage. And then you pair that with melee lifesteal, and now all of a sudden the percentage that melee lifesteal was originally taking is not just drawing from your initial hit with melee lifesteal. It is now compounding with the damage that you're doing because of the spirit strike and whatever spirit power that you already have. So this, you can build this up to basically be where you can do 1,000 hit points per swing per hit of a melee hit.
It's huge.
There's also something called melee charge. It's kind of like if you're a melee build, you're likely going to have something like this, but it does two things. It does increase your melee damage by a percentage. I think it's 25%.
50.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
So 50%. And then I think the best part of that ability is that you also are able to extend the range at which your heavy melee travels. So everyone has like a certain set distance with their melee and heavy melee that can go a specific distance. Melee charge, basically, it's either, I'm going to go ahead and say doubles. Do you think that'd be inaccurate?
Yeah, you go so far. Yeah. You go far.
So you can really close the distance with someone with a melee build with that kind of item.
It can be pretty unexpected too, because a heavy melee it gives you a very obvious telegraph. It's got a very particular sound that cuts through. It's got a huge yellow particle that plays, and you can basically see it from a mile away if you're paying attention. But also, if your attention is redirected on the million other things that are currently happening, you can usually get off a heavy melee in the middle of a fight, and that's a huge chunk of damage.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sneak them in.
Exactly. And just to briefly, you mentioned a word.
Telegraph. Oh, telegraph. You can also parry these things.
Yeah. Yes. Parrying is the bane of any melee build's existence.
Oh, yeah.
And every single character is embedded with the ability to parry, and the timing is really tricky to get down. I wanted to explain telegraph just real quick for those that may not understand. Telegraphing, whenever if someone is winding up a punch and you're able to understand that they're winding up a punch, that's called telegraphing, because you're understanding that they're about to perform an action before it actually happens. And they do that with like usually a visual or even a sound indicator. So just to briefly explain that. Pairing will fuck you so hard because
you're dead if you get parried.
If you get parried, that's right. Someone that plays Abrams a lot, I have to basically wind up my punch and then I have to determine whether or not the character in front of me has either already used their parry within the last 5 seconds, because if someone hits parry and then they don't get hit, it doesn't come back for a certain amount of seconds. So I can take advantage of them at that point if I miss their parry, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Or if they do parry me, then I am stunned for like
a long time. It's like 3 or 4 seconds.
It's a lot. So
I think it's like 2 or 3. I don't know.
Yeah, in the laning phase, a common occurrence is that like if I am doing this melee build and then I get parried, what ends up happening almost every single time is that the two people in that lane, the opposing team, will just converge on me and just beat the shit out of me, just melee punch me because I'm down for that long. And unless Painter is there to bail me out, I'm pretty much dead. There's just no way that I'm going to be able to do that because you're completely powerless in that moment. That's another one of those things where I'm just like, this is bullshit, but it's also a consequence of poor execution. I was going to say poor planning, but no. The thing is, though, is that like with your melee ability, you can swing that thing in any direction. It used to be a lot more
snappy.
And like, let's say that I'm facing the direction in front of me. If I hit melee and I hold melee and I'm about to charge it, I could feasibly turn directly around and just go the other way. Now, the way that they have it is on a curve. So basically, you can't just do that. You can't just like look one way, start a melee, and then just go 180 behind you. You have to react to that curve. So,
yes, limited turn radius is now in place for melee attacks, which makes it harder to fake them out, to bait out that parry.
Exactly.
But there are several items that you can use to cancel your heavy melee so that all you're doing is telegraphing one and you're not actually executing the heavy melee. That's a good way to bait out a parry too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a fun little mini game, the melee system. I love it a lot. You can play it on any character. Any character has some sort of path to become a melee character, even Haze, who can sleep dagger you and then just punch you right after that because you're slept and you cannot parry.
And that's the interesting thing about having builds is that you can subvert expectations. I'm gonna let you talk about that because you do a lot of that in your builds.
Yeah. So Ivy is, I play Ivy in all kinds of builds. Support gun. She's a small gargoyle that has a very cutesy voice actor. She has a large area of effect damage over time grenade. She has a buff for her teammate to increase their fire rate and remove a movement penalty after firing. And also has an invincibility ability called Stone Form. And like I said earlier, she can fly her enemies out. I mean, she can fly her allies out as well as herself of any danger. And so it's not really, it's like a support character or a spirit-based character, but sometimes I can play her melee, which is, subverting expectations. You don't think Ivy is going to run up to you and punch you for that amount of damage. And so that in and of itself gives me a free punch. And then either they panic parry or they expect another punch. But her stone form allows me to cancel that punch. And so already I'm guaranteed a few punches through psychology and just being Ivy and having the stone form cancel to bait out a parry.
Exactly.
But that the variety of builds that Ivy can use, any character really, it keeps it interesting. I don't know what I'm going to build whenever I'm going into a game as Ivy. I watch how the players play. I look at their team comp. I see what would be most effective, and I go for it.
Right, and which kind of tells you the difference between like, someone like me who has a general build in mind, something that I like my go to, and then I will adapt certain things about the build depending on like what I'm facing sometimes.
Yeah.
Versus like speaking to your point earlier about Ivy, you're not expecting an Ivy to have like a melee build. When you see Abrams, you are typically expecting that character to have some sort of melee build, so you're anticipating higher damage from them, and so you are preparing for that. I guess the equivalent subversion of that would either be like running a spirit where I have more damage outputting to my abilities, or even just using my gun, which is, it's only good at close range. So that's the other thing that kind of makes Abrams a, how would I say it? Like a, it's a specific in its usage. Like you have to be able to get close to your opponent in order to do some like actually meaningful damage. But if, let's say, for instance, with my shotgun pistol, I get a item that's called long range. Even if, you know, the character is a little bit farther away, the damage fall off, which occurs whenever an opposing player is farther away from you versus closer to you. There's a curve that occurs there that if they're closer to you and you shoot them, you do more damage. If they're farther away, you do less, all the way down to like 1 HP or 0 HP if you're just too far. And if I use long range, then I can still do effective damage at a pretty good range. And so if I pair that with weapon damage, and I pair that with maybe I still need to get a little bit closer, so I get an item like Colossus, where it gives me an egregious amount of health. It's expensive, so it's worth it. It's an expensive amount of souls that you would use. But these are all things that you have to think about whenever you're making micro and macro decisions in the game. So is it worth it to subvert the character if it means that, or the opposing team expectations, if you are challenging what is to be expected of your character, like Abrams melee gun, Abrams. And so you'll actually hear the term, you know, with Abrams as an example, gun Abrams, melee Abrams, spirit Abrams. And then I don't really hear like vitality Abrams, but you would just call him a tanky character. He's super tanky.
And sometimes it's ability based, like this is an infernal resilience Abrams, or this is an ult Abrams.
Yeah, like just items where like it's focused on one certain ability to maximize its potential. It's an interesting game.
Yeah, all avenues.
There's so many things, so many more things that we could talk about. I kind of want to end it here.
Yeah. So I kind of want to play a game.
I kind of want to play a game too. So if you want to play the game yourself, I would probably see if you can find a thread on Reddit that's allowing for invites. Maybe you have a friend that's already playing Deadlock. They would have to, an easiest way for, would be for them to invite you. We need more players.
Yeah.
So,
and we're getting more.
We're getting more, and the game has been recently updated to have a lot of new exciting changes, including new characters that you can play. Whenever things like that happen, it does kind of even the playing field for everyone in that sense. So it is a good time. I think anytime's a good time, but get to know the game. Really see if you can build your own community from that. I really want Deadlock to be successful, because it's one of those games that I think is just doing something fresh for the first time in a long time. And of course, it's Valve, so the quality control that I expect from this game is pretty much like at its highest level, which they do a lot of things to mitigate any sort of like challenges that you may occur, like any bugs or anything like that. It is still in playtesting, so that is something you have to remember, but
the polish is showing for sure.
You would think that they would have released this game about a year ago if you play it now versus what it was. It's actually insane between the art, the new characters, the abilities, the balancing of the characters and their abilities, and so many other things.
You can tell it's the culmination of like Valve's experience over the years creating games and like being in the industry and seeing what is successful, putting it all together and creating. I want to play a game, dude.
Yeah. leave it to Valve to challenge like, you know, preconceptions of what games should be now and just trying something new.
Yeah.
Which if you know, if for some reason the AAA developer is listening, I would just challenge you to really try something new. Don't try it from like a story perspective. Try it from a gameplay mechanics perspective and see if you can make something interesting and make a story around that mechanic. You know, that's just a something I want to put out there.
Even then, even if it's like not something new, like Deadlock, I think is more of like a mashup of ideas rather than like to make something new rather than like just something completely different.
That's so a good
even
point.
If you just take a mashup, like try it out.
Yeah.
I love to see this kind of stuff.
Invest in new ideas because like, you know, just a quick tidbit, more remasters, more games that have been like remade are seeing more success than some of the newer IPs that have been releasing lately. I think it's important to keep that drive for innovation like Deadlock has been for us and just open your mind a little bit more. And I promise you, if you have the right people that are great at making new ideas and you allow them to experiment with those ideas, then I promise you, your player base will appreciate that. And they're going to love that you're just trying something new.
Yes.
So even if it's weird, even if it sucks, there's some games out there that kind of suck, but I still hold in high regard because of how daring it was. Most of them taking place in the PS2 area. But that being said, this has been a side quest. Checking out Deadlock. Again, I'm going to encourage you to check it out. You'll find us here at Critical Debuff on Spotify, any place where you listen to podcasts. And be sure to let us know your questions. I mean, like, you know, I consider Painter an expert at this fucking point. I would say I'm pretty adept. We would love to hear your thoughts and like any criticisms that you have about the game, things that you would like to see. I'm sure Valve would like to see that too. And yeah, let us know. Try the game. Let us know what you think. And I hope to see you out there. Maybe you'll kill me. There's a high likelihood of that.
I'll see you in lane, y'all.
See ya. Have a good one.
Critical Debuff. Side quest.